good to get back into recording an album because I'd done the music for Broad Street, and that had involved doing a lot of old songs. And that was nice to do, but it wasn't as exciting as doing new stuff. So I like the idea of kind of writing and recording new stuff. So it was good fun.
The main aims when we started the album were to produce something a lot hotter and earthier than the previous two albums, Pipes of Peace and Tug of War, which Paul felt there were some great tracks on them, but some softish areas.
We expected more, but with one thing and another, we were trying to outdo each other in the tug of war.
And I think he also had a desire to get back to some of the earlier recordings of the Beatles, when you would go in and record an album in a couple of days, just by sitting down with the four guys and doing the whole thing together.
Hi, McCartney fans, and welcome to episode 106 of Two Legs, a Paul McCartney podcast. We are a Paul McCartney talk show mainly dealing with the solo career of the one and only Paul McCartney. I'm one of your two co-hosts, Tom Hunyadi, and you may know me from my other show, Talk More Talk. And I'm joined by my friend, my brother, my backwards traveler. He is the one and only Andy Nichols. Andy, what's going on, my friend?
Good morning, Mr. Hunyadi. How are you?
Yes. I'm a little bit tired. You know, it was another record store day yesterday, so yeah. Another all-nighter, but it was well worth it. I got, my wife and I, we got what we wanted, so we were happy about that. And
I didn't partake this year, but that's your department.
Yes. Yeah.
So, if I want something, I just tell you, go get this for me, please.
That's how it is, huh?
Well, kind of.
Yeah, but I'm just happy because this was the main thing I had to have. This is the second Judas Priest album, Sad Wings of Destiny, which is, you know, considered, you know, the birth of one of the births of heavy metal right here. So it's just a glorious album for me, and just love it. And yeah, right, exactly. And that crazy guy you see making the horns over there, he is. Our friend Owen Ling is returning for another episode, and we're going to be talking about a project that he just put out. I believe it's on pre-order right now, and he is, as I said, Owen Ling. Owen, what's going on, my friend?
It's going pretty well, yeah. I'm in the mood for some heavy metal. I'm your turbo lover!
There you go.
that's my personal. I'm so sorry if the low mood levels were too loud.
No, I have no idea what you're talking about either.
He was just singing a Judas Priest song, that's all.
Okay.
Yeah. It's the most
Turbo Lover.
Yeah, it's the most ridiculous kitsch of the Judas Priest, because it starts off with this symphony.
Yes.
You right. Will feel me. It's like this cabaret.
Yeah.
And then it goes to the chorus. I'm your death.
I love it.
I fell in love back in my uni days when I felt sorry for myself when all my other pals were off in Erasmuses in Spain and France and having a good time. I put that song on, and then by the end of the fourth listen, I was up screaming it out in my hall.
Nice. I love it. Anyways, we are going to be talking about the Paul McCartney-Eric Stewart collaboration today. Looking forward to that. But first, we're just going to talk about McCartney 3 a little bit more. Andy and I, we did a live video, what was it, Wednesday?
Wednesday night?
Talking.
22nd is when the video dropped.
Yeah, talking about all the different vinyl copies that were coming out. And the release date and our excitement. So we're really looking forward to it. And Owen, I mean, what are your feelings about this new project from McCartney?
It's, I mean, 2020 was a fairly horrific year, but of course, Paul came along to save us.
Thank you. There you go.
Paul McCartney, we are near the grace. The Lord is with thee. Bless my flower who keeps producing the tunes from which we devour at your presence. Give us McCartney free on this day.
Amen.
I will drink to that.
Now, there's a very good chance this could be your Maureen Cleave interview, and people will start burning two legs episodes.
Well, it's all the same concept. That means they have to download it first and then just get rid of it. So go ahead, right. Download it. We'll take
it. Yeah, and then download it again, you know. Right.
I'm really excited. My personal favorites of the McCartney series are McCartney's 1 and 2. So this was the Holy Grail. I mean, people are curious. People are wondering if this is his last album. If this is it, this is the mode. This is, you could not get on a higher high.
Right. I mean, the excitement level just for the fact that it's being called McCartney 3, it's just through the roof right now. You know?
Right. So, although you see today that there's a little rumor that the runtime is only 33 minutes long.
So no. With Revolver.
Yeah.
Which is fine.
It's much better than that.
Well, they said McCartney 1 is like 34 minutes, McCartney 2 is 38 minutes, so yeah. Whatever.
Yeah, I mean, that's fine. I'm fine. I mean, as long as the album is good, you know, that's all I care about, really. You know, I mean, all the different color vinyls, that's all, you know, it's all, you know, a bonus. That's
yeah, that's all fandom.
That's the cherry on top, really. But I mean, the more important thing is whether or not the album's going to be good or not.
Red, the Coke bottle, the blue, oh my God.
Right. Yes. Yeah. Yes. So,
I think I've got high hopes for it.
Yeah. Yeah. So do I. I mean, the what I heard from the trailer, I was very excited about it. I liked what I heard. So,
maybe one day this week or soon we'll hear that lead-off single sneak out, and that'll be nice.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we hope so.
The trailer was very clever in that it started off when it merged with the clips of McCartney 1, it seemed acoustic and pastoral. And then as the electronic came in, it went on to McCartney 2.
And I love the vision of the cassettes playing, you know, and then the vinyl. And where was all of this great promotional stuff throughout the 70s and 80s for Paul? I mean, he never would have left Capitol. I mean, if he was, if this much attention.
80s. He had it in the 70s, in the 80s.
Yeah, but it was the strength of McCartney, the name alone. You know, throughout the 80s, though, once you got into the 80s, I mean, he needed a little bit more, you know, help since you got all these other great up-and-coming acts, you know, really dominating the 80s, like, you know, the U2s and the Madonnas and then the Guns N'
Prince,
Roses.
And Prince. Well, this is going to tie into what we're this is going to tie into what we're going to talk about today a little bit because in the 80s, you know, he was very much kind of like considered an old hat by then. Which was 40 years ago, so here he is now 40 years later. But, you know, I guess that's why the Eric Stewarts and the collaborations were done to kind of get him back on track a little bit, so.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Certainly with Elvis Costello, that was definitely the modus operandi. They get to guess the young up-and-coming bohemian artist with all his, you've come, and trying to punch that's my petty Elvis Costello impression.
But I mean, as great as Eric Stewart is I kind of get a sense that he was brought in for more like, you know, the production side of recording, as well as, you know, the backing his backing vocals talent, you know,
the production.
Production wise, you know.
Well, certainly for, I didn't speak to that.
Certainly for Tug of War and Pipes of Peace, that's what he was brought on board for. But then it seemed but then Linda had the canny idea that Paul and Eric should write together.
Right. Yeah, we'll get to that as well. But first, I'm going to just do like a brief, you know, Eric Stewart bio. So those who aren't familiar with him, they can get a sense of Eric Stewart. And if they want to do more research on him, more power to you, because he does have an ebook out there that you can, read. I think it's still available to purchase too.
Absolutely.
Yeah. His ebook.
But
so
I would, I would forewarn readers. He's much like John Lennon. Eric is not one of those who likes to hold back. So for those whose favorite member is Graham Gouldman, you might not want to read this book because he doesn't hold back on his dismay, disgust, his
story. Yeah. Of Grant, his X10CC band member, right?
Yeah, so. Partner, I know from experience and from having interviewed both Graham and Eric that there's no love lost between them at all.
Wow.
Who's the closest member of 10CC that he remains with still to this day, Owen? Do you know?
Lol, because it came up in the interview. Because Lol and Eric married a pair of sisters, they're technically brothers-in-law. They're like uncles. So they've kept it. They're good pals, and they're
so maybe it's best that they didn't continue to work together. that's interesting. That's interesting. Yeah. Almost kind of like the Joe Walsh Ringo situation.
It's interesting. Even though Graham and Eric tended to write together in 10cc, and of course Lull and Kevin went to become Godly, videographers. These days, Kevin and Graham are very close mates. And Eric and Lull are very close mates. So it tends to be if you can interview Eric and Lull together or you can interview Graham and Kevin together.
Interesting. Okay. Yeah. Very interesting. Well, sounds like you're the man to talk to about this then, huh?
That's why he's here.
All right. Well, anyways, okay. So a little bit about Eric Stewart. He's born in January 20th, 1945. Started with a band called Jerry Lee and the Staggerless.
You got to say where he's from. He's a Manc now. Come on. Don't forget that. Well, he's a Manc.
There you go. Okay. There you go. He joined Wayne Fontana's backing band, the Mindbenders. I believe that was in 63. They scored a U.S. number one with The Game of Love. Love. they split with the Mindbenders split with Fontana in late 65, and then they scored a UK number two with Groovy Kind of Love. Now, if you're not familiar with that song, Phil Collins covered that song in the 80s and scored a pretty big hit with it. You're not a fan of that version there, Owen?
No, that's an understatement.
I'm not either, and I love Phil Collins, but I don't like that version either.
My favorite Genesis album is Wind and Wuthering. I think he's an extraordinary talent. He's a singular, but some of the choices he made in the 80s and 90s.
Yeah, that wasn't one of the finest.
Cringeworthy, huh?
Yeah.
Yeah. So after that, Eric Stewart then took the next chapter, next big chapter, and he invested in a inner city studios for £800 back in 1968, which later became Strawberry Studios. Named after what, Andy?
Strawberry Fields Forever.
There you go. Very, very, very good. Now, his Mindbenders band member, was it Graham? Also invested in the Graham Gouldman, also invested in the Strawberry Studios as well, right, Owen?
I'll correct you on that.
Because
in an interview I did with Graham Gouldman, Gouldman was an up-and-coming budding songwriter concurrent to Eric being this local superstar. So he was writing for the Yardbirds and he was writing for Herman's Hermits.
Right.
There's a story that during when they did Top of the Pops in Manchester, Graham's band, the Mockingbirds, which I think had Kevin Godley in the band, they were in a band together. They warmed up the crowd before the Yardbirds played one of Graham's hits. Graham did some writing for the Mindbenders. He wrote a song for them called Schoolgirl. She was a schoolgirl. Yeah, it's a bit racy. And then very briefly, in the last few weeks, Graham joined as their bass player, but not enough to make any significance.
Okay, very good. Glad to hear that. Thank you. So then during the whole creation of Strawberry Studio, then that's where Gouldman, Godley, and Lowell come into the picture. They work on the, what's the gentleman's name? I forgot to write it down. What's that?
So the band is called Hotlegs. Gouldman wasn't in the band just yet because he was
just
in
yet. America.
So it was Eric who knew, Graham knew Lull and Kevin from the Jewish Musicians Brigades. They were three Jewish guys in Manchester, right. Growing up, so they grew up in the similar area.
Right.
He introduced them to Eric. Eric asked them in, asked Lol and Kevin, do you want to come around and test some equipment and see what happens? And while there, they accidentally knock off a hit called Neanderthal Man.
Neanderthal Man. But before that, they worked on the Neil Sedaka album, though, right?
Sedaka. Neil Sedaka.
Sedaka, thank you. Yeah.
That was a little, by then Graham had come back and had met with the Hot Legs guys, and they said, do you want to join? And he said, yeah.
Yeah, hello.
And then they became this sort of in-house studio band for anyone who wanted to come to Strawberry to record an album or record a few songs, and they would back, and then they got involved with Neil Sedaka.
Right. And then at what point did they get, they got turned down by Apple as well, right? Were they Hot Legs at that point still?
I don't know about that. I know it was Neil Sedaka who told the guys, you guys are really good songwriters, get some of your songs.
Right.
Then Eric and Graham wrote this sort of Neil Young or Crosby, Stills and Nash knockoff called Waterfalls.
Right.
Kevin and Lol knocked off this sort of 50s pastiche called Diana, with Lol doing this high helium.
Oh, right. Yep.
Very throwback. Yeah, I saw that. Yeah.
So it's strangely reminiscent of McCartney's Oh Darling. Jonathan King, who's not a popular name these days, but back then he was a famous impresario. He said, that's the hit.
Okay.
And Donna was intended as the B-side.
Okay. Yeah. And then they signed with UK Records in 1972 and then became 10cc.
Jonathan King gave them the name.
Yeah. Jonathan King, that's correct. I think he said he had it in a dream or something like that.
Yes. Liam Newton, who's written the book on 10cc, says that although Eric and Graham make it seem like there was a big poster and 10cc, greatest band in the world, what really happened was he was looking... what's his name? Jonathan King was looking at various facts and figures and looking at accounts, and there was a lot of configurations with numbers and letters, and the name came to him in a dream, 10cc.
Right. And he said,
how about that for a name?
No,
romantic as you might think.
Right. No, I mean, Eric was, I mean, he got into, you know, playing music at a young age. I mean, when he talks about, you know, meeting McCartney in 62, you know, during a BBC audition, I mean, he had to have been, 17, so around that age.
Yeah.
You know, meeting McCartney, then the band, and then him thinking that this was the greatest thing since sliced bread. And I also think that he thought that the Graham thought that was Cliff Richards was the great thing at that point in time, wasn't it?
Not Graham. I don't think Graham would have been in the 10cc if that was his opinion. It was his bandmates, whom Eric hasn't named, who thought that. So
that's what it was. Okay.
The interview with Eric says, I thought the Beatles were great. Yeah. My bandmates thought it was Cliff Richard.
Exactly.
I did that petty Eric impression in front of Kevin Godley, and he said it's not bad. that cheered me up.
Right. So, Eric Stewart must have left a pretty good impression on McCartney, because then they stayed in touch throughout the 60s and 70s. As we know, the McGear album was recorded at Strawberry Studios. I believe it was the Strawberry Studios North, because there's two, right? North and South. Right. So let's just give us a rundown on 10cc, Owen, because they didn't have the success here in America like they did in the UK, but they still had, you know, I'm Not in Love. They still had, you know, Things We Do for Love, which were big hits here, but it seemed like they had more success in the UK for sure.
Well, for sure. Yeah. I think as Kevin Godley has said in several interviews, part of the problem with 10cc was they didn't have a long-legged frontman like Roxy Music had with Brian Ferry.
Or Freddie Mercury. Right.
Yeah, exactly. Bill Collins.
But the cool thing about that band was, is just like they're like, you know, like the Beatles or other bands where they had multiple singers, which I think is a really nice touch.
Absolutely, yeah. As Graham Gouldman points out, that they had three UK number ones, all sung by someone new.
Right. Yeah. Right. which I think is really cool.
It's huge, yeah.
Yeah. It's, so, I mean, what kind of give us
it's, like, well, I was going to say, well, go ahead, Owen. Go ahead.
No, go ahead.
No, I was going to say, just watching, there's a great documentary on 10cc on YouTube, which you kindly shared with us, which I watched, not really knowing a lot about 10cc, the inner workings of the band, Jonathan King, whatnot. And it's still, what I took away from it was still pretty sad to see that even in the mid-70s, there's a band still kind of getting screwed by, you know, management. And that story about how they wanted to sign with Virgin and they left. And Eric Stewart got off his plane, and they found out that they weren't really going to be signed to Virgin. You would thought by the 70s, after what the Beatles had gone through, that kind of stuff would have gone away. And here's a great, good band getting the shaft.
Yeah, I'd say it still goes on to this very day. I mean, but then again, concurrent to 10cc, we have Badfinger, and yes, we don't even need to go into that horror story.
Oh,
no.
I think it's well documented that that's like the, if you're in a band, you're in an up and coming band and you're getting ready to sign a deal, watch the history of Badfinger before you sign any deal.
Yeah. And something about Eric mentioning that he just signed off, they gave power of attorney on the contract, and then, you know, that's why, you know, he's like, oh, it still bothers me to this day, what he said in the interview. Oh, okay. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. No, but I know what you mean. Yeah. That story.
Yeah, give us a sense of what kind of a band they were. I mean, were they really versatile in different genres of music?
Well, yeah. So obviously you had Graham Gouldman, who was this budding busy bee songwriter who could knock off like a blues hit for the Yardbirds and then a nice pop hit for Herman's Hermits. Mm. So that was his school. Eric was very much a blues rock kind of guy. He's a lead guitarist by trade, who just happened to have a really good voice. He became the lead singer of the Mind Benders by accident, right, not by design. Mm. And then you had the other two, Gobbly and Cream, who were art school graduates who listened to a lot of Frank Zappa. So you had all this varying melting pot of influences and hybrids and the fact they laced it with this wonderful ironic charm, and they didn't take things very seriously. One of 10cc's earliest triumphs was a song called "The Dean and I," which is like a 50s pastiche, melted with Eric's wonderfully heavy 70s rock riff burning over it.
Right.
So it's this weird dichotomy of like sweet 50s musical with a heavy metal chugging riff on top of it.
Mm-hmm.
They had a huge hit in 1973 called Rubber Bullets.
Rubber Bullets, so, yeah.
It's a score. This sort of almost a status quo rollicking number.
Yeah, it seemed like it had a little bit of glam rock in there too, into my ears.
All but the image.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
There's a story that when they turned up at Top of the Pops, one of these programs, because you had like Bowie, Mark Ball, and Brian Ferry, each of them like trying to out glam each other, and then these guys come in their denims, and someone says, "That's a good gimmick. You guys are coming up in jeans." They record sheet music in 1974, and that's just to show their wonderfully dark sense of humor or self-effacing humor, that when one of the critics calls their music shit, if you forgive my language,
right,
they decide to throw that back in his face by saying it's not shit music, it's sheet music. So that's wonderful. And
right,
what also added to 10cc was that they didn't stick religiously to one writing partner. One of the heavy rock numbers in the 10cc canon is one written by Eric and Lol called Silly Love, which is this turbocharged, almost Thin Lizzy-led number.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And Graham and Kevin wrote together. Graham and Lol wrote this song called The Worst Band in the World.
I really enjoyed that one. I watched that performance on YouTube, and I really, really dug that. So I definitely want to, you know, get some of those early 10cc records for sure.
Yeah. So that's generally considered by everyone, including the band, as the 10cc's finest work, the sheet music album.
Okay.
In the center of it, you've got this wonderful, glorious piano piece called Somewhere in Hollywood, which has Kevin Godley on vocals, and he's singing to, you know, the glories of cinema's past, and
right.
like soundscaping the listener with, you know, with a litany of beautiful imagery of cinema. And naturally now, Kevin Godley is one of like the foremost pop video directors. He's done videos for U2.
Beatles, right. too. Yeah.
Yeah, he did the Real Love video.
He
yeah.
did.
Yeah.
And Kevin, there's a version of Kevin Godley singing Real Love floating out there, too. I don't know if you've heard that.
Oh,
yeah.
Really? I didn't know that.
Yeah.
Wow.
There's a Kevin Godley mix of Real Love, actually. I guess maybe he used it as a guide vocal for the video, but...
Yes, I think it's because he feared the video, the song being leaked ahead of time. So to give him a sense of where the video was going, he recorded it himself. And
yeah. Yeah, it's pretty interesting.
Oh, yeah. Kevin's considered by many to be the finest singer in Tennessee, the range and the
distance. Yes. Yeah, yeah. Now, to that point, then, when you get these four individuals that have, you know, different ideas of where they want to go, sometimes that works because then, you know, everybody comes together and puts something great together, like, you know, I'm Not in Love, which we'll get into for a second. But it also, you know, tends to, you know, break a band up, which unfortunately, you know, that original four, those original fours, they didn't last that long.
No, it's not even 5 years. I think during the How Dare You album, the cracks started to appear, where it became quite clear that Eric and Graham liked having hits and being on the road and being in a successful band. But they enjoyed the danger and the process of creating great art ahead of having mass success.
Gotcha. Even though some of their songs that they were putting out were hits, I mean, it just wasn't, you know... Stewart and Graham's vocals that were successful. I mean, it was, you know, there you go.
Yeah, very much, yeah, very nice. It's very much like a true democratic band. Yeah. A lot of bands were like that. Queen, where every band member contributed something unique to the band. And they're really, Kent, the story of 10cc should be more widely told, because it's really an amazing group of guys. Even just in my limited learning about them, is made me want to learn more about their discography and what they've done. So, and the talents that are in all those four guys are just amazing.
Absolutely. So yeah. the split happened officially in 77.
Okay.
When Kevin and Law had started a project to finesse the use of a device they'd created called the Gizmo.
Gizmo, which, right.
Yeah. The Gizmotron, which Paul McCartney used on I'm Carrying and Jimmy Page used on In the Evening.
Okay.
Yeah.
Gotcha.
They wanted to showcase every permutation and ability, so they came up with a triple album, which was costly, and it bombed, and it came out amidst punk, but they had to make a decision. Do we want to focus on Consequences or 10cc? And they chose Consequences. So then the other two carried on as 10cc, and they had their biggest US hit with The Things We Do for Love.
Which was, I think, 77, wasn't that? Right after. So that was the album then, right after Godley and Lowell left the band then. So obviously then they bring in more members to continue going on. So when Kevin and Lowell then left, and their direction was just a whole different, you know, thing, you know? So, I mean, you know, then they have a few things. Obviously, I think their biggest hit would have been Cry then in the mid 80s. I would imagine. But, you know, what kind of band was that then, their whole thing?
Godley and Cream, I don't think they saw themselves as a band. I think they saw themselves as a creative duo. One of their remits was music, one of it was video, one of it was creating devices. Mm. I think their bread and butter, as we say over here, was directing videos. So they directed, like, Relax, that wonderful... Two Tribes, where that wonderful fight between Reagan and Gorbachev, or the two powers or whatever, but that wonder with puppetry and surgery. That's one of Godley and Cream's Every Breath You Take, with, you know, the black and white silhouettes and Sting looking forlorn, thinking about the love he's never going to regain. That's one of theirs. Yeah, they were like the go-to directors until they split in 1989. And Kevin's continued directing LOL, not so much, but LOL's gone back to working with Trevor Horn as a guitarist and a keyboardist. And
Right. Because, correct me if I'm wrong, when Trevor Horn was involved with that album that Cry was on, correct? Absolutely, I think he produced it. Which I'm finding out that I didn't realize that he was such a prolific producer. I mean, he was producing a ton of stuff in the 70s and 80s.
Trevor Horn?
Yeah, Trevor Horn.
Oh yeah. Yeah. Well, because you're not a Yes guy. So.
Yeah, exactly. I'm not a Yes guy.
Come on.
Yeah. So, but anyways, so then let's talk about I'm Not in Love, because there's the technique, which I think just really, you know, changed a lot of music, and just an amazing track. And I was really surprised with the technique, because I really didn't, I mean, as much, I'm a big fan of that song. I love the song. I listen to it often, and but I wasn't really aware about the production side of it. So,
they talked about in the documentary, there's only four guys.
Yeah, exactly.
So how do they,
four guys. So how do they do it? But it was, I was surprised it was really Golly's idea to have that constant, to kind of make it almost like a non-music song, to where it's just the lyrics, and then you just hear voices throughout the song, which I was really blown away by that idea. But then obviously then they add the backing track, which I think just to move the song along, which I think helps the song out a little bit too. But the whole technique was really cool to hear about it.
Yes, that's one thing that amazes me about Tennessee. No matter how much another member felt about a song, they always brought their A game to the song irregardless. So Eric Stewart despised The Dean and I, which I mentioned earlier, because it was so 50s musical, South Pacific,
right.
You mispronounced it there. But he still brought that like that lacerating, burning guitar riff to it. Some balls. And Godly absolutely despised I'm Not in Love in its original form, which was this very samba based I'm not in love.
Right.
He thought it was horrific, and he wanted to bend the track, and his way of saving it was a wall of voices.
Wall of voices, right. Yeah. Which I think which I think that technique blended itself well to the song Take It Away, which we'll get to,
But I mean, that could really, which is that a case of Stewart kind of taking credit for what Kevin Godley kind of came up
with? No. Eric's very happy to say Kevin came up with the, he said it in my interview with him. And also, I'm choking on the irony here, but Richard Buskin might not be a McCartney fan, but an outstanding interview about I'm Not in Love is one Buskin did with Eric Stewart for Sound on Sound in 2005, 2006.
Okay. Yeah. We'll start to look at that then. Cool. So then let's talk about Stewart, even though he's still working in 10cc, 10cc is still a band as of 1980, 81. Then he's brought in to help with McCartney during the tug of war. As we know, tug of war or Wings is pretty much done with now. So Paul's had this, let's just get other people in, other people that I like. So like Stevie Wonder, like a Gadd, like a Clark, these types of guys. So he's bringing in just like studio musicians to come in and help. And one of the people that he brings in is Eric Stewart, but he's just pretty much brought in, I think, more as a for help for backing vocals at the time, I think.
Yes.
And this would have been at Montserrat, right, at Air Studios when Stewart first came into the fold on these sessions. Owen, do you know?
Yes, it's somewhere. I'm not sure if it's Montserrat or London, but it's definitely the tug of war where he's brought in to record backing vocals. I don't know if he plays any guitar on Tug of War.
I think
he played guitar. He's credited on guitar, I think, for Pipes of Peace.
Right. Yep, he is. Yeah.
But very much that transition, because Denny Lane and Eric Stewart are changing doors, and one's going out and one's
coming in. Yeah, right.
Yeah.
which, you know, in a way, it suits itself well, because, you know, even though Denny Lane is a talented guitar player and vocalist, so is Eric Stewart. So it's almost like one, you know, switching one out for the other, really.
Yeah. You know?
However, I think Stewart and has more experience on the other side of the mirror on the window than say Denny Lane would.
I mean, as a performer.
Performer, but as behind the scenes as an engineer, because he's really well known as an engineer at that time, mm-hmm. and as a songwriter. So
yes, well, is I would say, as the way Eric would see himself as professionally, is he's a musician first, producer second, songwriter third. Mm, okay. I think that's how he'd view himself.
Interesting.
But he was very much the chief engineer and chief producer in 10cc. They all turned to his studio acumen he was the one who was behind the controls as Lol, Graham, and Kevin recorded countless vocals for I'm Not in Love.
Gotcha. Okay. So, and that was like a built up of, like, I mean, it just starts off with the three and then they just record over. I mean, it's just this constant build up until you just got this choir sounding, you know, track that they can just lay down while Eric does his lead vocals for the song. Yeah. So
apparently Eric got his vocal in one take.
He said it was a one take, or it was even the guide vocal, he said in the documentary.
Yeah. That's the passion that was coming through, because it's a song he wrote for his wife. His wife said to him, "Why don't you say you love me?" And he thinks, "Well, I don't have to say it every day. Why don't you just show me?" It's very much coming from out of him.
Yeah.
Right.
It's a stunning vocal.
Yeah.
Amazing.
So I was kind of surprised to learn that, you know, as I said, 10cc is still a band. So I think Eric Stewart jumps aboard early 81. But then 10cc, they still put out two albums during that time, 10 out of 10 and Windows in the Jungle. And that's still with Graham as well, correct, Owen?
Yes. In 1979, after they're riding high with hits like Things We Do for Love and Dreadlock Holiday, which I don't know how big a hit that was in
America. I don't remember hearing that at all.
So. Okay, but I'd say I'd say in Ireland, like, for one, that's like the 10cc song, Dreadlock Holiday.
Okay.
After that and I'm Not in Love. Around that time, I think it's in 79, that, very sadly, Eric was in a near-fatal car crash, which nearly cost him his life. It did cost him a lot of his eye, which is why in subsequent videos you'll always see him wearing sunglasses inside.
Oh,
right.
Wow.
Yeah.
Okay.
I've seen some people on McCartney's Facebook page saying, "Oh, look at Stewart being such a ponce. You know, look at how he thinks he's so cool wearing dark sunglasses," with people not realizing it's a disability.
There's a reason.
Yeah.
Wow.
He got ponce look, you know, like he didn't want to be there or.
Yeah, and plus dark shades is a lot cooler than an eye patch.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And on the Strange Brew podcast with Jason Barnard, Eric Mensch talked about how while he was in hospital and he's coming out of various sleep forms, he gets a call from Paul. He's like, Paul, is that you? And apparently that brought him back to life. So that might be part of the reason why he felt indebted and got involved with the studios, because he was so in awe with the kindness. Around that time, he had a falling out with Graham Gouldman. Gouldman had a project called Animal Olympics. Eric thought that maybe Graham was following up on it a bit sooner than he should have, given that Eric was recovering. I don't know. That's Eric's point of view. Graham would probably say that, well, what am I going to do? I'm a musician. I need to keep busy.
Right.
But
gotcha.
So that's where the rift starts to happen between Eric and Graham, according to Eric. Andrew Gold, who's a big, huge star in America.
Right, yeah.
Yeah. He got involved with the 10 out of 10 album.
Okay.
Because the American execs said, you know, we can't hear any hits amongst the tracks. We've got this guy, Andrew Gold. So he writes a couple of songs with them, that which are released as singles. And once 10cc split up, Gouldman and Gold form a band called Wax.
Mm.
Yeah.
Okay. So then these two 10cc albums that come out in, I think, what, 81 or 82, 83, yeah, right around that time. I mean, was that more of a collaboration between Goldman and Stewart, or is that just a lot of, you know, friction involved in those two projects? Do you know?
Huge friction. There is one track where Eric refused to sing on one of, and which is a song that meant a lot to Graham. And like, I mean, we're talking almost White Album territory here. Of like, when you record your song here, and I'll record my song here.
Okay. So, but these were pretty much probably still under contract where they had to do these albums, though, I would imagine.
I don't know about that. I don't know if it's for love or for contract or for money, but
okay, because it's like, you know, if you're not getting along, why continue to do albums associated with that other person? Then,
Right. Oh, maybe contractually they had to.
Yeah, that's what I mean. Yeah. So.
Yeah. Although what's interesting, in 1983, one of the last 10cc singles of that era was a song called "Feel the Love," which didn't do anything. It's a forgettable song. Their former bandmates Godley and Cream came to direct the video. It was a mini 10cc reunion.
Very cool. So then now with 10cc out of the way, it looks like Eric Stewart's is spending more time with McCartney, continuing to work with McCartney throughout Tug of War, all the way up to Give My Regards to Broad Street, which he's now, you know, also doing more instrumentation on that album, not just the backing vocals like on Tug of War. So let's just talk about some of the, you know, the highlights with Eric Stewart on, let's say, like Tug of War, with a lot of the... Now, instead of Denny Lane, now we are all familiar with Wings and those backing vocals. You know, with Linda and Denny. So now you're just taking one out and bringing the other one in with Eric Stewart. And you really, in my ears, there's really not much of a difference. Because those backing vocals are wonderful, especially on something like Take It Away, which at the end, when you get those ahs, you know, it sounds like
it's a 10cc track.
It sounds exactly like they did the same thing with that they did on Love.
I think that's Eric Stewart's, probably, you know, that's his lasting legacy with McCartney's music, is that part of Take It Away. I mean,
right.
Come on, that you hear that and you know that's Eric Stewart's stamp of approval. That's what it is.
Also, it's very much Eric saying, "Paul loves my techniques. This is astonishing."
Right. And again, that's some years after I'm Not in Love, but still resonated with an audience to do very well.
Yeah,
right.
Absolutely. I mean, fans of I'm Not in Love range from Paul McCartney to Axl Rose, of all people, talking about metal.
It doesn't surprise me, you know, one bit.
It's very adult contemporary, right? But it doesn't mean that it's not good.
It's very cool in a way too, with that effect going out throughout the whole song, and then lyrically too. I mean, I guess you could take it that song in different ways. You know,
sure.
I'm not in love. You know, and more of like a rebellion side of a relationship or whatnot, more or less than a sincere side. You know, and then there's also Average Person, which also has a lot of backing vocals with Stewart and Linda, which are, you know, is another track that I, you know, like backing vocal wise.
Yeah. So Bad as well.
Well, yeah. And then when we get to Pipes of Peace, then you got So Bad, which is the main thing. But, you know, Paul rewards Eric Stewart by having him in the Take It Away video, which is really cool to see. And then same with So Bad as well. So, which again features some really nice backing vocals with Eric and Linda as well. And then same with Through Our Love too. So,
I asked when I did, I had the pleasure of interviewing Eric Stewart 2 years ago. And when I asked him about the So Bad, I said, "What was it like being in a video with Paul and Ringo?" He said, "Dream come true."
Yeah,
I mean, which
not only once, twice,
in the film too, right?
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So three times, really, when you think about it.
Yeah, Take It Away, and So Bad twice,
and then So Bad again for
Broad Street.
Broad Street. Yeah.
Absolutely. Yes.
Interesting
Eric's
stuff.
Not a fan of Broad Street, the film.
Well. Andy. That's who. <Really? laughs> Andy's in love with that movie.
Yes, I am. It's so
soundtrack is still like, okay.
It still boggles my mind that Broad Street was a number one album in the UK, and so poorly. Yeah. But at that point in time, McCartney wasn't really, you know, doing that great in the UK. I mean, he was getting more. He had more success in the US than he did in the UK. Then all of a sudden, this as great as the album is. Don't get me wrong. I think the album is great. But it just didn't do that well here.
You know, no, it didn't. And it's just it's strange to think about. Really, you've got this period of time that Eric Stewart is working with McCartney, and it's especially now in light of the Flowers in the Dirt archive coming out again, and all the attention that project got with Costello. The Stewart McCartney Stewart collaboration really has flown under the radar, and that's not just like one album. That's a few years. It's from 81 to about 86 of collaborating and working on projects, which, you know, after Denny Lane and Wings, that's probably the most significant amount of time he worked with somebody. So a period of time that really is grossly underrated and is deserving of a look, in-depth study for sure.
Mm-hmm. Much like 10cc.
Right.
Yes.
Yeah. So I would imagine when we do get a Press to Play archive, we'll, you know, it'll get reevaluated again favorably, like all the rest of these albums have been doing.
Yeah.
But hopefully we'll get more of a Eric Stewart production.
Yeah. And maybe it's an opportunity for, and I read your wonderful interview with him, Owen, which was fantastic. Okay. And but it was disappointing to read about how, you know, when he got the phone call from management saying that, you know, Hugh Padgham has said that's enough and we're gonna end this. It'd be nice if at some point the waters have been smoothed over between Eric and Paul, and if not,
well, they have. They're still friends,
right? But maybe the Press to Play archive campaign can help kind of bond, you know, bring those two a little bit more closer, and, you know, laugh about it 30 years later, you know.
See Eric laughing about it, but it's okay.
Well, I mean, well, you gotta laugh about it. It's music. It's not rocket science.
Yeah,
you know.
I get that point, but, you know, as you can tell in Owen's interview and other interviews that he's done, like Super Deluxe, that he's just not happy with how that album turned out. Really,
no.
So
there's an interview with Eric in 1992. In fact, with Graham as well. It was concurrent to the Meanwhile album.
Meanwhile album.
Yes, which is not a very good album. It was So it was produced by Steely Dan producer Gary Katz. I'm not too well versed in Steely Dan, so I don't know. But given that Kevin Godley sang on one track, I'm meant to do a backing vocal on that track, the executive had marketed it as a 10cc four-piece reunion when it was anything but. It was it was one track. So Eric and Graham are touring in Japan, I think it is, and where they're fending off a lot of questions of where are the other two, and these two guys aren't getting on particularly well. They're trying to put their differences aside, but they're unsurmountable. And Eric has asked what he thought about Wax, which was Graham's other band, and he says, they were terrible. Which, you know, which Graham, you know, can't have been too pleasant for Graham to hear.
Right.
And then he's asked about Press to Play, and he said his vision of the album was four guys in the room, like it was in the Beatles, blasting out rock and roll. He says, but he said it became this like studio spectacle of like
right. Yeah. And we'll talk about that in a minute. But then now they move on to, you know, Broad Street, which, you know, Eric lends his backing vocals to No More Lonely Nights, both versions, the play out and the ballad version. So that's, you know, one of the highlights for that for his backing vocals. But by that time, I think he's also, you know, doing guitar on a bunch of tracks as well during that period of the Pipes of Peace and Give My Regards to Broad Street. So so then there's a little bit of a break. There's, I know Paul then goes to David Foster after that. They record a few things.
Live Aid, of course.
Live Aid. And then I believe it's the, you know, they're having dinner with George Martin, and George Martin is the one to suggest to Eric that maybe he produces Paul's next album.
Yes, that's in the Norman Sounds book, where I think George was undergoing fatigue from like the demands of Paul, and
George
at this point, while he's not at the point in his career where he doesn't have the ears to produce the Beatles, as I said, in the 90s, George Martin must have been 60 at this point, so maybe he didn't feel he had the energy. We're close. I mean, he must in the mid-50s anyway, so he wasn't as sprightly as he had been 20 years earlier.
Sure.
Yeah.
So at this point, he thought maybe Paul needs someone a bit younger and a bit and Eric, why don't you do it? You've got the know-how.
Got you. So then Paul rings him up and asks him, "Do you want to produce?" Then I guess it would be the next follow-up. Step for Paul to do, and then I guess Eric agreed. I believe the first thing that they worked on was the song Angry, and Eric talks about how he laid down a really angry guitar riff, and then the next thing once the album comes out, it's Pete Townsend and Phil Collins, which he feels it wasn't so angry.
that was Hugh Padgham, I'm sure,
right
behind that.
Right.
Well, yeah, because it's, you'll find with fast forward 20 years down the road, Nigel Godrich is fed up of like Paul's bandmates coming in and turning into a bit of a party session. He says, no, we have to work, get rid of the band. Like, I think that's Eric's point of view of like, why are you bringing in Pete Townsend from The Who and Phil Collins? This isn't a party, this is an album. Let's
make an album with you. Right.
Right. So I guess then things were, well, first of all, after that, Paul rang up Eric Stewart, but his wife answered, and he told his wife to tell Eric that he's a genius after what he heard from listening to that angry track or playback. So, he's got to be on this all-time high now. Here's, a genius, which Eric Stewart has called Paul McCartney a genius, and now Paul McCartney is calling Eric a genius, so he's got to be on this just all-time high. This is the peak of his career, maybe, who knows. And then all of a sudden now you've got tensions now with Hugh. He brings Hugh in to engineer, and I think he's a little excited about that because he's well aware of Hugh's work as an engineer at that time and producer. But then I was reading how Hugh would call Eric Stewart him rather than Eric, which I thought was kind of fascinating. But then I think Eric wanted Paul to do a vocal over again, and I think that's where the tension started getting a little sour, because then I think Hugh said he wants you to do it over again or something like that, and then a meeting then they had a meeting after that, and then the next day where I think they had a meeting where Eric said, who's producing this album? And then that's where I think Paul says, the three of us are. So I think that came like a really big surprise to Eric. So from being on this all-time high, then all of a sudden now just, kicked off of this high horse, I guess. Yes. Had to have been a shitty feeling for him.
It had to be, but Hugh had quite the pedigree at this point. Phil Collins comes to him and went to him in 1980 saying, I've got this bag of demos. And Hugh turns it into Face Value, which was like the album of 1981. Like, it was In the Air Tonight.
Yep.
What other songs are on Face Value? I think it's an excellent album.
Behind the Lines. Behind the Lines. His version of Behind the Lines is on there. It's,
wonderful.
So then the next day he gets the call saying that he's taken off the project, which it's an unfortunate that something like that would happen. So, but I would imagine that he was probably just really disappointed about that.
Eric?
Yeah, Eric, taking off the project.
I think disappointment doesn't even broach it. I'd say it was gut-wrenching, heartbreaking.
Sure. Well, because it's somebody that he looked up to and was somebody from his youth. And you've built up a professional rapport with. He was like a godlike to him in the early, in the 60s, and now he's working with him. And then this guy who he's idolized and worked with professionally has to tell him sorry. So it must have been gut wrenching, and it's probably.
Well, I think it was Linda that delivered the phone call, and again talking to Eric's wife again, and said, you know, sorry, you know, no hard feelings. Hope we can continue to be friends.
Well, Linda, it might have been management. I don't know. I don't know if Linda would have made the call.
I think Linda would have. I don't see why Linda wouldn't have. Yeah. Another thing about Eric is he's one of these artists who's so invested in his work that it's not just work to him. It's
part his of life.
He's giving part of his soul, which might be the reason why he might be hurt. He's made no secret of the fact he's not happy with Graham Gouldman touring with 10cc without him.
Okay.
Who knows what it's like for him to see another singer sing I'm Not in Love when it means so much to him.
Right.
Sure.
So this was going on then in the 80s? Was that's when Graham started touring as 10cc by himself?
No, that was much more. That's been in since about 2000, 1999.
Okay. Right. Okay. Because I heard that was happening. I just didn't realize when that started. Mm. So, but yeah, to your point, I would imagine that he wouldn't have been too happy about that. Yes. You know.
In Graham's defense, if Brian May can tour as Queen, why can't Graham tour as 10cc?
Understood. Yeah. Got you. So let's talk. So before the recording start, they write a bunch of songs together. So let's just stroll down the songs that they did write together. First on the album, Stranglehold, which Eric Stewart has said that I guess the horns were added later after they had already worked on the song. So, but you know, I've always been a fan of Stranglehold. I mean, I'm fine with that. You know, what are your feelings about the song Stranglehold? Owen.
I think it's one of the more tasteful productions. It's, you know, rustic, it's it's pounding, it's rollicking, it's got the 1950s swagger, and you have the Careless Whisper saxophone coming in.
Right.
It's not too overblown. I have much greater criticisms with some of it later on. It's you know, it's rollicking good fun, McCartney. It's similar to My Brave Face. It's a good time song.
Opener. Yeah, it's a typical album opener. It's not as good as My Brave Face. I would have liked to have heard it without the horns.
You know, I'm a huge fan of the 80s horns throughout the whole decade. I mean,
you
I
don't
think
say.
Some of the best songs in the 80s has had great saxophones, whether it's Careless Whispers or, you know, Tina Turner, I mean, the Boss, I mean, Huey Lewis, I mean, on and on and on. Some of the great songs from the 80s had great, wonderful saxophones throughout them. The song True from Spandau Ballet, I mean, so many great tracks. So, but to hear, you know, Paul try it and not work in my sense, I mean, I would love to hear the song, like Andy said, without the horns, you know, on it. So,
I'm wondering if Blade Runner was an influence, because there's that wonderful love theme in Blade Runner with the sax and
right.
You know, the forlorn Harrison Ford looking, you know, wafting over the city with the right.
Mr. Vangelis, of course.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
So, and moving on, then we go to Footprints, which is one of my favorite songs on the album. Song started off with Derek coming in through that walk in the snow, and then telling Paul that it's beautiful outside, and there's your first line, you know, and then the song comes out of that. Andy, your thoughts on Footprints?
I think we documented it on our Skipper Play It. I was kind of, I'm this way, that way with it. Not too keen on it. It's okay. It's a nice song. But I like some of the other songs better that they collaborated on the album.
Gotcha. Owen?
I'm totally the other way. This is the McCartney of For No One, of Here, There, and Everywhere.
Yeah.
I'm going to go out and say something that most of the listeners may disagree with. I think this song is better than any of the Costello McCartney co-writes.
Oh. Wow.
I think it's...
High praise. I love it.
High praise.
It's astonishingly good. Like, this is the McCartney of Revolver, you know, lacing... another day, you know, mindful of, you know, of a passerby. It's the kind of song John Lennon would admonish him for, but I praise him, I celebrate McCartney for. It's just gorgeous. The weather, you know, we're weathering with it, and then we go to that. It reaches this wonderful high point with the bridge and how it turns into an angelic undertone. It's an extraordinary song.
I'm going to put my Owen hat and re-listen to it and give it another shot. I will.
Yeah.
Based on that review.
But, One thing
I listened to Eleanor Rigby first and then listened to Footprints or something like that.
Okay.
But go ahead, Owen. Were you going to say something else?
Yes. When Eric brought that up in the interview that Paul came along and when he came along to Paul and he says, "It's beautiful outside," and Paul starts singing, "It's beautiful outside." I said, there's a similar story in when Paul met Dustin Hoffman, and
yes.
Dustin Hoffman's talking about Picasso, and Eric says, "Yes, Owen."
Yeah.
Paul told me the story.
Yeah, that's funny. Another track, Pretty Little Head, which I would imagine probably completely different than, how the song turns out on the finished project than what I'm sure Eric and Paul probably demoed at first, if they did do a demo. So again, I prefer the single version over this one. How do you think about the production on this track, Owen?
I think it's excellent. I think is it Carlos Alomar playing guitar? That's spacey,
yeah.
Almost shoegaze.
Mm-hmm. Right.
I think it's excellent. I love the dream pop lyrics. I love the way the vocals come in and out. There's some sort of studio effect, so it doesn't sound like Paul's regular voice.
Right.
I like the samba beat. I think it's wonderfully hypnotic.
Right. I'm curious about how. Because it's that I don't know. I don't remember if it's on. I don't think it's on the single, but on the video where you briefly hear She's Leaving Home before, mm-hmm. And I wonder if there's any kind of like copyright issues why they couldn't put that on the album.
Probably. I mean, I know it's
But whoever had came up with that idea to put She's Leaving Home right before the song starts on the video, I say good on ya,
I have no reason to prove this, but part of me suspects that She's Leaving Home, Another Day, and Pretty Little Head are a trilogy.
Trilogy, okay. And trilogy.
It's called a spiritual thing. Yeah. Thank you, Andy.
Moving on, Move Over Busker, which is not a favorite track of mine on the album. What say you, Owen?
It's all right. I remember listening to the Take It Away guys, who have a superb podcast. So I don't know if they're still going, but they're raving, saying, "Oh, this is like a wonderful Wings number," and I'm like, "No, it's a choppy riff looking for a song. It's okay. It's okay. It's not like top tier Wings. It's fine.
The lyrics are funny. I actually like it. Yeah. I do like it a lot more than I ever used to. I just, the Errol Flynn stuff. I like
it. Right.
Mae West. I like it. Yeah. I do like that song.
Gotcha. Again, with the one track where we're going to have to see if we can find a bootleg of this with Angry, and hear, Eric Stewart's, guitar version over what, came to be with Townsend and Phil Collins, what do you think, Owen?
I agree with Eric. I mean, I he didn't say this per se, but my vision of it is a helter skelter laid back with Paul screaming, "'Cause I'm angry!"
Right.
Yeah.
I know when Eric was reciting it, he was like snarling, like, "Angry!"
Yes.
Yeah. Whereas when we hear what's all ostensibly a pop number, it doesn't sound very angry.
Angry, right, right. Because I believe he was reading tabloids at the time, and Eric
too much
Stewart
of the sun, went, too much of the
yeah,
sun.
Yeah, too much of the sun. And then here's Eric Stewart, saying, "Hey, let's get it down on paper."
Yeah,
perfect. Yeah. Yeah. And that's a good, partner right there, let's get that feeling down on paper. Yeah. Then we move to the last track, However Absurd, which again, very beatily after the finished project, don't know, how they worked it to start, but one that I've never been the biggest fan of on the album. Owen, what are your thoughts?
Well, I really rate it. I know in Peter Doggett's book, You Never Give Me Your Money, I think he describes that as a self-conscious number. I don't think it is at all. I think it's he's parodying his past as much as he's reclaiming it. Mm-hmm. And it is a wonderful soundscape with, the banging to the piano, which leads into this, massive Colosseum exhibit of vocals.
Mm-hmm. Right, right.
And they also wrote, they did Right Away too, right?
Well, that's the next song I'm getting right. to. Well,
you said that was the last one.
Well, on the album.
Oh, isn't right away on the LP?
Yeah, on the LP, I think it's the last track. But then we get into the CDs.
The CD, okay. I always forget how the CD and the LP differ. I always think the LP ends with Right Away, but it ends with
Hell Over Absurd. It ends with Hell Over Absurd. And then we get to the B-sides, which then the B-side for Pretty Little Head here. Then you get Right Away, which I think is, you know, again, another throwback to, you know, Paul's, you know, wonderful piano type tracks, and you know, love this song, Owen.
Yeah, no, I'm with you there. And are we going to get on to Tough on a Tightrope in a minute?
We are.
We'll get on to that right now.
We're on to that right now. Tough on a Tightrope. Why was this not on the album? It is astonishing. Like, it's got this. Beautiful vocal. It's got, you know, there's so much humility to it. It's like he's pondering all his failings. He's pondering all his values. He's, you know, it's the sound of someone wondering how to improve themselves. It's the type of humble McCartney we rarely see. It's the McCartney of the Tug of War title track, where, you know, he's wondering, he's querying how difficult life is.
Yeah.
Why is this not on the album when there's so much crap on the album?
If that one really should have been on there, and the single remix is way better than the one on the bonus track, I've always felt. Right. You know,
what would you take off to replace it with?
The rubbish title track.
Press?
Yeah.
Wow.
Wow,
those are some brave words. There's a lot of fans of Press out there, my friend.
I think Mark Lewisohn described it as the worst thing he'd ever heard Paul write when he first heard it.
Wow.
Interesting. Yeah. Interesting. Then getting to another B-side, this time from your favorite track, Press. We got Hang Glide, which is just, I believe, just an instrumental. And a nice little instrumental at that. I don't think it's the greatest thing. I'm not the biggest fan of Paul's instrumentals that are out there, but this one isn't too bad, Owen.
You tell that to youth that you're not a fan of his instrumentals.
Come on, you don't like Front Parlor? Come on.
Not the biggest fan. Not the biggest fan, but go ahead.
There's better instrumentals. I mean, the instrumentals, the interludes that we hear on the first McCartney album. Like, I think it's Mama Miss America with those charging drums and those pounding pianos. I think that's a much finer instrumental. It's okay. It's not about.
So then we get to two tracks that were demoed, and unfortunately not released on a McCartney, an official McCartney, which is and we've got Yvonne's the One, which demoed and is well known out there as one of the great, you know, unreleased McCartney tracks out there. However, it was technically released when this was on the last 10cc album, Mirror Mirror, which gave it a more of a reggae feel to it, which I think Eric Stewart is a reggae fan as well. And spending a lot of time in Jamaica with Paul and Linda. What are your thoughts on this one, on this bootleg version, Owen?
I'm gonna go with the 10cc version over the, but I do like this version. It clearly sounds like a demo, and it does have an earnest Beatley vocal on it, and it's very, very cute. We're not hearing the finished product, so I don't know how, but I do like the reggae makeover 10cc. Well, even though it wasn't actually 10cc by then, by that album, which
it was like two solo albums or something like that, which was described as
yes, it very much is like, I mean, Graham's recording in London and Eric's recording in France where he lived.
Yeah, doing research on that, I think they said that there was only one track that they worked on together on that album, Graham and Stewart.
Yeah, the remake of I'm Not in Love.
No, I'm Not in Love.
It all comes back to I'm Not in Love.
As it should.
But Yeah, unfortunately, I'm not the biggest reggae fan out there. So I do really like this demo version. And if there is a Press to Play archive release coming soon, I would shoot somebody. Well, I shouldn't say that, but I'll be really pissed if
it'll be on there. Calm down.
Yvonne's the One is not on there, but
it'll be on there. Yvonne the One. That's a tremendous track. I prefer the Paul demo version, but that's just me.
Yeah. So then we've got the song, maybe I should have said first, Don't Break the Promise, which, again, another co-write. But you have Grant Goldman on, I think, on the songwriting credits for this one as well. This one it was on the Meanwhile album, which was the one before Mirror Mirror. Yeah. And so your thoughts on this one? Because not only is it on, it's on Meanwhile, but it's also on the Return to Pepperland bootleg
right.
as well. So, Owen?
I think Goldman's co-write is basically a courtesy because Eric and Graham were supposedly at this point, or they were presenting themselves as a songwriting partnership, but Eric and Paul.
Okay.
Yeah, I like most 10cc fans. Meanwhile, it's probably the nadir of their expansive legacy. It's also a shame that four bohemians in the 70s who could produce such wonderful music in a studio in Manchester
right.
are now sort of catering to the whims of bankers and executives.
That's all too familiar of a tale with music and musicians and bands.
Mm. Gotcha. Yeah, so I do like the demo that's on the Return to Pepperland bootleg. You know, I think that's a pretty good, nice version. So, unfortunately, as we said earlier, you know, things didn't work out for Eric during the Press to Play sessions. However, they mended their friendship, and Paul does perform on Yvonne's the One and Code of Silence on the Mirror Mirror album, which was, you know, nice to see that they were able to get together for that.
I don't know if it was recorded whenever that album came out. It's Mirror Mirror is 1995, isn't it?
Yeah, I think so. Cause the last
one. They were recorded like 10 years earlier, but it's nice that Paul was good enough to say, yeah, like you can right. use those tracks.
Which was right. cool of him to do, right. of course. Yeah. You know,
absolutely.
Okay. Just looking at the CD case here, and I've never noticed this till now, but looking at the credits, it just says special contribution by Eric Stewart. Ah, that had a bonus. The 86 EMI first pressing has just says special contribution Eric Stewart in it on the CD case.
Produced by
I didn't even realize that, and I've owned it for 25 years, but special contribution that's got to burn his ass.
I mean, Elvis Costello thought he was going to record an album with McCartney, and that never happened.
Exactly.
Yeah. So let's just talk as a whole. I mean, where do you see this collaboration in the few collaborations that Paul has had as a solo artist with others? You know, where do you rank this collaboration, Owen?
Oh, I think there was a very strong collaboration. I mean, and as I say, I mean, if all they produced was Footprints, I mean, we're talking one of the finest ballads of, we're like, a ballad that's like top tier.
Right.
If that's all they produced, then thank you for that.
Right.
I think part of the reason why McCartney went with Elvis Costello was he wanted someone who was wholly different. There's a good chance he thought that he and Eric had too many musical similarities.
Right.
They were too close. And like Eric's own, even though Eric's resume started in the 70s, he's only 2.5 years younger than Paul.
Right.
Too close. Yeah.
So he wasn't one of the new wavers or one of the punk rockers the way that Elvis Costello was. And
right.
He wasn't from the pop funk field the way that Michael Jackson or Stevie Wonder were.
Yeah, and I think Elvis is a little more interesting lyricist-wise than you know, and there's a lot of, you can tell there's a lot of similarities musically between McCartney and Stewart as well, you know. So, Andy, where do you put the, where do you rank this collaboration?
I think it naturally falls after the Denny Lane and Elvis collaborations right now. But I think once this album is given its archive treatment, I think it's going to, people are going to really, really evaluate it and have a newfound appreciation for the work of Eric Stewart and 10cc. I really believe that's going to happen. I firmly believe that. I do. And hopefully most people would agree.
Yeah. I tend to look at, when I think of songwriting collaboration, I tend to look at lyrically more than the finished product, music-wise. I just tend to look at the lyrics, and then looking at the lyrics on a lot of these songs, Stranglehold, Footprints, you know, Right Away, Tough on a Tightrope, Yvonne's the One, I think though that's what I look at, and I would say that this is kind of more like on an even level with the stuff he did with Denny Lane. I would almost say it's like 1A, 1B, where it's just underneath the Elvis Costello collaboration.
Yes. We're talking just one album here, but the way I'm looking at it is I'm bookending it from like Tug of War to Press to Play as the window of the time of the collaboration, not just the one album, although that's the one album that he obviously co-wrote the most, worked on with, but I kind of look at the Eric Stewart period in the McCartney canon from Tug of War, ending it at Press to Play, and looking at it on those terms, it's a very, you know, fruitful period.
I agree. A very fertile period.
Yeah.
Gotcha. Cool. All right. Well, before we call this episode, Owen, my friend, you... I've written a book. Let's talk about that.
It's a book about a little known band from Ireland called U2. They might have had one or two hits. U2. They might have had one or two hits in America.
A couple, I think. I think I recall seeing a couple of their videos in the '80s. Yes. What's the book entail?
So it's an album guide, so it's a run through their songs, their albums. There's a mild McCartney connection in that when they performed at Live 8, 8 being the number, in 2005, they performed Sgt. Pepper with guess who?
Paul McCartney?
Yeah. But you didn't know that? Oh, fair enough.
No, I knew.
I didn't know if you were joking.
Yes, I was joking. Oh. Sarcasm.
And they released that as a charity single in 2005.
I remember that.
Yep. Do you have it, Andy?
Yes, I do.
Oh, good. You can have it all, Andy.
He's got it all. Yeah. Cool. And then, so you track by track and just, is this like an opinions book? Are you giving your opinions on those songs, or are you just talking about the songs in general in passing?
Yes, I mean, naturally I had to model it on Revolution in the Head, the wonderful Ian MacDonald.
Ian MacDonald, yes.
I'm not as gifted a writer as he was, but that was my benchmark, my tome. It's a look at their discography more so as a life work rather than as like album per album. That was an interesting way to look at it. The one challenge I took on the book is I didn't want to focus on the major albums like Octoon Baby or Joshua Tree, and then skip through like No Line on the Horizon. It's like, no, each had to be equally attention.
So now, were you approached for this book? I mean, this isn't a self-published book, right? This was a, you know, an effort that you did for a publication.
Yes, for Sonic Bun. So I pitched it to them about this time last year, and they said, let's go with that.
Okay, cool. So,
rapid fire. Yeah. Favorite U2 song, everybody, go.
Oh, jeez. Favorite U2 song. Owen, give me a second. You go ahead if you have one.
The Unforgettable Fire, which is heard on The Unforgettable Fire.
Okay.
I'm going to go with the live version of Bad on the Wide Awake in America EP.
I have always been a big fan of Angel of Harlem. What's the one for Desire as well from, I'm a big fan of the Rattle and Hum album.
Nice.
You know,
and I believe it's version, yeah, it's great.
Yeah. So, those, I mean, and plus you can't go wrong with, Sunday Bloody Sunday and New Year's Eve as well. I think those are two
New Year's Day,
you know, thank you. New Year's Day, two great, tracks, you know, isn't I always at least say something wrong on every episode.
I think I read that there's going to be a deluxe edition, 20th anniversary of All That You Can't Leave Behind coming out as well. Is that true, yeah. Owen? Yeah.
Yes. Kevin Godley, who directed some of their videos, posted to it on his Twitter page. Mm. He directed the video for some. Yeah, I know. 10cc are everywhere.
The 10cc Beatles hybrid kind of, you know, cross college. This is like amazing how many strands all between Trevor Horn and McCartney and you know, Godley and the anthology and now, you know, Eric Stewart. It's like, it's pretty cool.
I know, it's extraordinary. I mean, yeah. But I know, I don't rate the number too highly of Real Love. I think the way that he intersected, you know, the visuals to the music, and you can see that as we journey with the Beatles on various strands of their lives, that has often left me in tears. That might be Dudley's finest video.
Agreed.
So where can people find your, what's it called? I mean, where can people find it? You know.
Oh gosh. So YouTube, every album,
every song. Yep.
Well, thank you. You can find it on Burning Shed, Amazon, Book Depository. Yeah, it's just up there.
So it's available for people in the U.S. or around the world, not just the U.K. and that side of the country, right?
It will actually. I need to backtrack. It will be available to the people in the U.S. I'm not entirely sure if the release date has been set up, but it will be made available.
Okay,
awesome.
But it's definitely made available for the U.K. and Ireland right now. Okay.
It's just pre-order at the moment, right?
Yeah. With COVID and everything, everything's all up in the air, but the book will arrive.
Okay.
Well, many congrats on the book, Owen.
Well, thank you.
Yes, excellent. I'm glad something came out of this terrible point in time. I mean, well,
it's what I spent my lockdown creativity. Right. Where McCartney records an album, I write a book.
You write a book.
There you go.
That's great. And you've got thoughts about future projects as well in book form?
Oh, yeah. I would at some point like to write a Beatle book, but it'll either be Paul or George. I think there's enough John Lennon books out there.
Oh, yeah. It's so saturated with Lennon right now. I mean, I think Womack just put the cap on the Lennon, you know, for a while, and then obviously we've got the McCartney legacy coming out next year, which we'll see how that is. Hopefully, it's going to be a killer
it's
book.
Be fantastic.
Yeah, absolutely. Kind of
Lewison esque.
Yeah, maybe kind of like the Lennonology book as well, kind of like maybe in that sense where it's almost kind of like in a diary form, you know, going day by day.
Day
after day. I think listening to Kozin talk about it, I think they said that there was only like in the four, or I think in the 5 years that they write about, there was only like a month point in time where they didn't have something, you know, to talk about, you know, so they really,
amazing.
They really, you know, had a lot to put down.
I haven't met Alan, I'm so sorry.
No, go ahead.
I haven't met or spoken to Alan Kozin, but I know Adrian Sinclair fairly well. We're Facebook friends and we've spoken on the phone a couple of times and I email him all the time. And his research is second to none.
Yep. Yeah. I would like to get him on the show just to talk about research. Okay, well, we'll do that. We'll do that. Okay.
You're checking all my boxes now. Popular music, his geography. Yeah. You're getting into the indie world now.
Right, because now that the book has been submitted to the editor, I don't really 100% sure about how the editor will want them to talk about the book just yet until closer to the release date.
When that book comes out, we got to go live too.
Yes, absolutely. Let's do that as soon as we get the book in our hands.
I know.
Yeah. So,
So that's why I'm thinking maybe I should go. I should write one on George Harrison, because
yes.
There's no when you've got two guys as committed and as prolific right. and as excellent as those two are.
Right.
Yeah. You know?
Right. But here's the thing: is though at the moment I think they're only contracted to do the first two volumes, so that might be a good good thing. Like if they're only going to do the two volumes, then maybe that's a good point for someone else to jump on and say, hey, okay, let's I'll do this I'll do the third volume or something like that. Depending on how successful the two books are to begin with. If they're successful, then I'm sure there'll be some pressure to continue the series, I would hope, anyways.
I know that Mark Lewison said that someone should write a book on the Broad Street period, but he said mm-hmm. there's no chance he can do it given given
yeah. yeah. But
I'm working on developing and doing some research on that right now.
Yeah, that's great.
Yeah, so
the official word right there.
I'm working. I would like to do a book on this period of Paul's career, solely on the 80s. It's something I've been working on and talking with people about, and getting advice. And I'm just doing some preliminary research and doing my pitches right now. So I think the 80s,
oh, wow.
and only the 80s, needs to be discussed. And stay tuned. Right. But yeah, I'm working on it now.
Mm-hmm. Oh, wow, Mazel Tov.
Thank you. So this is why I was like this, getting a chance to talk to you today really, really helps, obviously, with the research. So thank you.
Oh, you're right. That's very kind of you. Yeah.
So
when you're thinking, Owen, that, okay, maybe I'll do a book on George Harrison. I mean, what are your thoughts about, what area are you looking to write about? Are you thinking about doing a biography? Are you thinking about doing just on an albums? Or, I mean, what are your thoughts on that?
My preliminary thoughts on either McCartney or Harrison would be looking at them in the 70s as artists, because both of them followed their gut more so than they followed common sense, I suppose you could say.
Or trends, maybe.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, especially George. George famously despised following the latest trend.
Mm. Yeah. Okay, cool. Well, let's make that happen, buddy.
Well, thank you. Yeah, that's, have you got a book planned, Tom?
Do I?
Yeah.
No, I often talked about if I were to write a book about McCartney, I would try to find some kind of gimmick that hasn't been written much about, try to find something out there. I mean, I just don't want to write the same boring biography,
Right.
Why keep doing that, But like Andy's got a great idea, which just about the 80s, which a lot of people look at that as not a really prolific time or not a very busy time, when I mean he's in the studio and he's in the studio nonstop throughout the 80s.
That's why that's why I think that period below that, the 1980s, really, really needs a proper analysis and review.
Yeah.
And hopefully with the release of McCartney 3, people will see McCartney 2 as the classic that it is.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Loud and Quiet in their interview declared McCartney 2 his finest solo album, and I applauded it.
I'm sure you did.
Right.
Yeah.
It is definitely a grower. I'm seeing more and more fans for that album over the years, especially on the Paul McCartney Facebook pages. So.
Yeah.
Yeah. You got any contact information where people can get a hold of you if they want to chat with you there, Owen?
Oh, I've got a WordPress, so it's Owen Ling, and you can contact me there. I've got a Twitter, it's at EMLing, and that's probably the best way to get hold of me. If you contact me through my WordPress, that brings you to my personal email.
Okay. Sounds good. Right. So we'll put the links on for that. We'll put a link for your book as well, so people can find, maybe hopefully if they're YouTube fans, hopefully they'll want to check that out. So
that's very kind. Right. Yes, I think you two are much more popular in America than they are in Ireland. A lot of people don't want to seem like even though many people adore you two, they don't want to seem like they're you two fans. They want to, it's Ireland's like Britain in that way, in that we don't appreciate success for whatever
reason. As much as, elsewhere they do, yeah.
Yeah, it's curious.
All right. Wow. Interesting. Okay. So thank you very much for being here. Andy, you want to add anything before we sign
Thanks
off?
Thank you to our ever-growing list of subscribers on YouTube and following our two legs. We're just, cranking the episodes out and posting them every Saturday. So we appreciate your support and your comments. So keep those coming.
Yep. Cool. Owen, anything you want to add before we sign off?
Well, thank you for having me, and I hope I passed the audition.
you did good, kid. You did good. Yeah, yeah. Keep going, keeping on, my friend. We are everywhere. We are Twitter, Instagram, Facebook at Two Legs Podcast. You can email us at twolegspodcast@gmail.com. As Andy said, YouTube, our YouTube channel is
website.
Two Legs. Yeah, we'll get to that in a second. The YouTube channel is Two Legs, a Paul McCartney podcast. Please check that out and subscribe. Our new website, twolegspodcast.com, that's where you're going to find a lot of the latest news. You'll find our latest episodes up on there as well, and that'll send you to our YouTube channel, so please check that out. Oh, what else? Jeez, that might be it. That might be it. Coming up next, we've got the drummer extraordinaire, Dave Maddox. Really looking forward to talking with him. some great work that he's done before McCartney, after McCartney. He worked with Paul on Tug of War, Pipes of Peace, Broad Street. He worked with McCartney on the Run Devil Run album. So really looking forward to talking with him about that. He even toured with Jethro Tull, which was pretty cool as well. So, I mean, for all the Tall fans out there, you probably
thick as a brick, that, baby.
Yeah. Good stuff. So, check that out. So, again, for Owen, for Andy, for myself, Tom, as always, you guys have a great day and a beautiful night. Take care.
Bye.
Listening to Two Legs, a Paul McCartney podcast, hosted by Tom Hunyadi and Andy Nichols, with musical contributions by Dylan.